recognize that some had other responsibilities tonight, so we appreciate all who have been able to make it to the meeting. Make you very welcome and trust you'll remember tomorrow night in the will of the Lord. We'll be very glad if you're able to come on that occasion as well. Now, our reading tonight is from the first book of Kings and chapter number 12. The first book of Kings and chapter 12. And we'll start to read at verse number 1. 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse 1. And Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel were come to Shechem to make him king. And it came to pass, when Jeroboam the son of Nebat, who was yet in Egypt, heard of it, for he was fled from the presence of King Solomon, and Jeroboam dwelt in Egypt, that they sent and called him. Jeroboam and all the congregation of Israel came, and spake unto Rehoboam, saying, Thy father made our yoke grievous, now therefore make thou the grievous service of thy father, and his heavy yoke which he put upon us lighter, and we will serve thee. And he said unto them, Depart yet for 3 days, then come again to me. And the people departed. And King Rehoboam consulted with the old men that stood before Solomon his father while he yet lived, and said, How do ye advise that I may answer this people? And they spake unto him, saying, If thou wilt be a servant unto this people this day, and will serve them, and answer them, and speak good words to them, then they will be thy servants for ever. We'll maybe go to verse 12. So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day, as the king had appointed, saying, Come to me again the third day. And the king answered the people roughly, and forsook the old men's counsel that they gave him, and spake to them after the counsel of the young men, saying, My father made your yoke heavy, and I will add to your yoke. My father also chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions. Verse 16, So when all Israel saw that the king hearkened not unto them, the people answered the king, saying, What portion have we in David? Neither have we inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel, now see to thine own house, David. So Israel departed unto their tents. Verse 18, Then King Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was over the tribute, and all Israel stoned him with stones that he died. Therefore King Rehoboam made speed to get him up to his chariot to flee to Jerusalem. So Israel rebelled against the house of David unto this day. And it came to pass, when all Israel heard that Jeroboam was come again, that they sent and called him unto the congregation, and made him king over all Israel. There was none that followed the house of David, but the tribe of Judah only. And when Rehoboam was come to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah with the tribe of Benjamin, 180,000 chosen men, which were warriors to fight against the house of Israel. Then the prophet tells him not to fight. Verse 25, Then Jeroboam built Shechem and Mount Ephraim, and dwelt therein, and went out from thence, and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, Now shall the kingdom return to the house of David, if this people go up to do sacrifice in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem. Then shall the heart of this people turn again unto their Lord, even unto Rehoboam king of Judah, and they shall kill me and go again to Rehoboam king of Judah. Whereupon the king took counsel and made 2 calves of gold, and said unto them, It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And he set the one in Bethel, and the other put he in Dan. Verse 31, And he made an house of high places, and made priests of the lowest of the people, which were not of the sons of Levi. Verse 33, So we offered upon the altar which he had made in Bethel the 15th day of the 8th month, even in the month which he had devised of his own heart, and ordained a feast unto the children of Israel. And he offered upon the altar and burnt incense. That's all we read from the scriptures tonight. I think it's practically unnecessary for me at this stage in the meetings to be rehearsing what we have been and are attempting to do in the few meetings. Most of you are aware that we have been seeking to take a look at some of the significance of the scriptural scenes at Shechem. And we have been emphasizing just how important Shechem was in the storyline of Holy Scripture. We have been emphasizing that it was a very important place historically, because it was the very first place at which Abraham pitched his tent when he came into the land of Canaan. So it was important historically. It was also important geographically because of its position just at the navel of the land. That's the expression used in Judges 9 and 37. It's described as being at the middle of the land, or the navel of the land. The literal expression is it was commanding a very strategic position in a very beautiful, fertile valley, nicely protected between the two mountains, Ebal and Gerizim. So it was important geographically as well as historically. It was also important commercially, because those northern, southern trade routes moving from the plain of Jezreel down to Beersheba and on down towards Egypt, and moving from the valley of the Jordan over to the coast of the Mediterranean, there was constant commercial traffic coming east-west and north-south, and Shechem was an important place commercially. Also, it had importance religiously. It was one of those cities, because of its centrality, it was selected to become a city of refuge. And it was also a city appointed by Joshua, the Lord through Joshua, appointed to be a city of the Levites. So it had great importance religiously. And then fifthly, and this will be very, very much to the fore tonight, there was a stage, especially in Israel's history, when Shechem became an important place politically. So we have moved from Abraham, the days of the patriarchs, into the days of the conquest in the land. Last night we've been in the days of the judges, and now tonight we are right into the days of the kingdom. Jacob at Shechem, Joshua at Shechem, Jotham at Shechem, tonight Jeroboam at Shechem, and then, as we have constantly repeated, tomorrow night, the Lord Jesus at Shechem. Just to keep us all together and to keep us moving so that we'll all get into tonight's subject, on each one of the situations we have been noticing that there is a different emphasis and a different lesson, a different topic that has been tackled. When it was Jacob at Shechem, the big thing there, Shechem was a place of compromise. Jacob should have been at Bethel, but he stopped at Shechem. And he didn't make the progress that he should have made, and the costliness of all of that. When it was Joshua at Shechem, as you remember, on Tuesday night, it became a place of consecration. Joshua told them, he said, you can't have any double dealing. He said, put away the gods. He said, don't be trifling. He said, I have made up my mind. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And he said, you serve the Lord in sincerity and truth. And he said, everything that you have, lock, stock and barrel, consecrate it to him. And under Joshua, Shechem and the stone of Shechem became a symbol of consecration. Last night, Jotham at Shechem, it became a place of confusion, a place of cursing, a place of calamity. The men of Shechem, very much unadvisedly, they promoted a person into power. And of course, we saw in last night's meeting just how big a price they had to pay for that promotion. What then is the subject before us tonight? What happens at the story of Shechem here? Well, I would put over it, one of the words that I'll put over it, we may have others before we just get finished. One of the words that I would put over the story tonight in 1 Kings chapter 12 is Shechem as a place of conflict. The nation has come to the edge of a precipice. They have come to a watershed in their history. On this very sad occasion, there is a division takes place in the kingdom. And we want just to look at the causes of division and what actually created the sad rift that took place here. You can see from the reading that there was a very great conference at Shechem, according to 1 Kings chapter 2. King Rehoboam, all the people came to Shechem. Then Jeroboam came to the conference as well. There was quite a bit of discussion, and eventually, when the conference was over, Shechem actually became the headquarters of the new kingdom of Jeroboam. So that Shechem plays a very, very important part in this particular chapter. Now, I want to think about a conference and the subject of conflict resolution. I think we would have to admit, dear brethren, that we are not really so good at resolving conflicts. Now, they had a conflict here, and because they didn't get it resolved, it produced an ugly division. And the sad fact is that that ugly division hasn't yet been healed. A nation that for over a century and a half had been cemented together in a fairly good unity. I'll mention other weaknesses later on, but they had been cemented together in a fairly good unity. As a result of what happened at this one meeting, they are just torn down the middle. Well, not even the middle, over towards one side, ripped right down the center. And that ugly tear has never yet been healed. Now, the thing is, it need never have happened. It need never have happened. If there just had been a man or two at that conference with a level mind and a steady heart. Sometimes when the brethren have conflicts, even in an assembly like, you know, the meetings, and there can be conference, and there can be coming together, and there can be things said, and there can be attitudes hardened, and there can be positions taken, and divisions created, and united, and there can be seeds of bitterness sown, and there can be splits and schisms started that last for years. When the years of sorrow are past, and men would take a breath and look back upon their history and exactly the way it happened, they have to hang their head in shame and say, if we had it to do again, we could have avoided the whole business. Now that's what happened here. There wasn't a man that was there able to resolve the conflict. So we have conflict at Shechem. To try and get our subject so that you can follow it and see exactly how the thing took shape, I want to divide the subject into a number of little parts. First of all, I want to think about the reason for convening the conference. We say a little about that, not too much, just at the beginning. Then secondly, I want to think about the request that was presented at the conference. Thirdly, I want to think about the response that was given at the conference. Fourthly, I want to think about the reaction, or if you like, the rant that took place at the conference. Then I want to think about the repair that was attempted after the conference. And finally, we want to take a sad look at the results that sprang from the conference. The reason for it, the request at it, the response given, the rent that was caused, the repair that was attempted, and the results that lasted. Well, as far as the first matter is concerned, there's really not very much difficulty, because we are told here in verse number 1 of chapter 12, Rehoboam Shechem, for all Israel come to Shechem to make him king. I think that Rehoboam went to that meeting, he went to that large conference, a very optimistic man. He thought that he would come back from that particular convention with a crown upon his head. But instead of coming back from that convention with a crown upon his head, he came back from it with 10 threads left. So he went optimistic, and he came home a defeated man. Furthermore, it's not just that he went to the meeting to get crowned, but the children of Israel, it tells us here in verse 1, all Israel were come to Shechem to make him king. So they came. He went with the intention of having a coronation, and all Israel came with the intention of having him crowned. I would take it, it's probably true that Rehoboam had already been crowned, maybe at Jerusalem or somewhere down in the lower part, somewhere in the southern section, he had already been crowned. The fact that he had to go up to Shechem in the middle of the northern part of the land to get a second coronation, that was already beginning to show that things were not just as close as they should have been. If they had been really close, the one crowning at Jerusalem would have done. But Rehoboam is conscious that there might just be a little bit of friction. It has been going on for years. And just to make things sure, to cement his whole kingdom together, he goes happily up to Shechem. He says, "They'll crown me. I'll become the king of all Israel." And he said, "I will just carry on the great things that took place in the days of my father Solomon." So he went to the meeting with the very highest hopes and with the very best intentions. And the purpose, the reason for this meeting was for the coronation of one king over all Israel. That will bring me very quickly to the second point. The result that he intended didn't materialize because when the conference started, there was a request that was presented that he never anticipated. The request that Israelites, using Jeroboam as their mouthpiece, is recorded for us in verse number 3 and verse number 4. It tells us they sent, that is, the children of Israel sent, and they called for Jeroboam. And Jeroboam came, and they said unto Rehoboam, verse 4, "Thy father made our yoke grievous. Now therefore make the yoke, the grievous service of thy father and his heavy yoke lighter, and we will serve thee." Was that a genuine request, or was it not? Had Solomon been too heavy on? They said he made our yoke grievous. Did they really have a justifiable complaint, or were they just being point blank awkward? Were they making a mountain out of a molehill, or was there something? Now let me say, brethren, if you find a little bit of friction in the assembly, if the thing is going to be solved, and if a split is going to be averted, one of the things that you will have to do is, even though you might not like it, even though your initial reaction would be, "We are not listening to any nonsense," one of the things that you will have to do is, you'll have to listen to the complaints of other people. Sometimes people can be crushed. Sometimes even the assembly, government can be so heavy-handed that people can just be ground into the dust. Now these people said, "Solomon, we will crown you and we will serve you, but before we put the crown upon your head, we want to put a complaint into your heart." And they said, "We are not prepared to go on if you're going to be as hard on us as your father was." Was the father hard? You see, I thought that Solomon was the ideal king. He was anything but it. Solomon finished up very poorly. Solomon started off with a most glorious and illustrious kingdom. The building of the great temple, his works and his wisdom and his writings, we think about them still. But as Solomon's prosperity increased, he took from the hand of his father a kingdom of peace. He turned peace into prosperity. As his prosperity multiplied, Solomon began to love it, and he developed for himself a very luxurious lifestyle. And he had great big dinners. And he had quite a number of wives to keep. And they are expensive commodities. I gather from what I hear in different continents of the world, they can be quite costly to keep one or two. And if you're going to keep hundreds of them, and Solomon wanted to act as a great big king, because you see, in the Oriental setting, the more wives you could keep in your harem, it showed that you were just a big wealthy king. So if he had hundreds of them, and he had great big banquets and great big dinners, and he had great big fancy buildings, and I tell you, he was not afraid to spend the money. The expenditure at the latter part of Solomon's reign was absolutely excessive. But if he was going to put the money out, how did he get the money in? Well, the way that he got the money in was plant big taxes on the people. And he even made some of the people work for nothing, practically nothing, in labor gangs. And to sustain his exuberant, luxurious lifestyle, there were other people suffering, and he certainly made their yoke hard. Now, this bit of friction, that coming to his son, is nothing short of a situation that was created by the heavy-handedness of his father. Can I say, dear brethren, in your administration of the things of God, don't you be so hard on the Christians that you'll make it difficult for the next generation. Don't be crushing people. Don't be making people live like slaves. Don't be setting yourself up as a great big tyrant, as a great big king that has everybody coming to kiss your toe, and everybody jump when you say jump, and everybody say bow when you say bow. That's just the way that Solomon, everybody working for him, but nobody point a finger. I'm going to do what I like as an Oriental despot. And he made a heavy yoke, and that created problems. And still in assembly life, I have seen it many times, if government is too hard, it will only be a matter of time until people can bear it no longer. So, they said, now are you going to be as hard with us as your father was? Jeroboam was the chairman of this meeting. Now, he wasn't just altogether a great character. We'll be talking more about him shortly. I'll admit, when they wanted a man to present their complaint, they picked a man that they knew wouldn't be behind the door. Jeroboam was a man that already had a chip in his shoulder, and Jeroboam was a man that had already had problems with Solomon. And he didn't get on with Solomon. And because he didn't get on with Solomon for reasons that I might be able to mention, I don't know, I'll say about the time here. Because he didn't get on with Rehoboam's father, he just walked out. I never like to see a man that just walks out because he can't get on. But he just walked out. And he just cleared out, and he went away to Egypt for years. And then when Solomon died, he said, I'll tell you what. I'll take advantage of the old fellow's death. You know, there are some men very quiet until older people die. I say to younger men in this meeting, and I'm putting myself amongst you, and what I say to you just comes back to me. It's a very despicable thing if we take advantage of the home call of an older man. And take advantage of the gap that's left, the vacancy that's left by his home call to promote our own cause. But Jeroboam was there, and he had this old score to settle. And he said, oh, I tell you, I'm the chairman. Leave it to me. I know what to talk. I talk. And they got a good spokesman. So the problem was, the thing was a bit mixed up. They had a good spokesman in the sense that he could talk. He presented the thing with a bit of a twist. He wasn't himself a straight man. But then, despite all of that, the complaint that he did make, it had a certain amount of substance to it. One of the things that aggravated the people and made them just chaff a little bit more was this. When Solomon put these taxes, these levies upon the people, especially the house of Joseph, he didn't put the levies on the house of Judah, his own tribe. And the people didn't really like that. Why is it that we have to work like slaves to keep his big lifestyle, and he lets his own tribe off? scot-free. So as well as being hardness in Solomon's administration, there was impartiality. He was harder on other people than he was on his own tribe. My dear brother, can I say to all the brethren here, there's nothing will undermine your respect amongst the Christians than if they can notice that you're very heavy-handed on everybody else, but you're very easy on your own family. And impartiality in Solomon's administration created a problem for his son, and so these people made the request, will you be easier on us? And if you're easier, we'll give you a crowning. It wasn't such a bad thing. And they sort of warned him. And he knew old Jeroboam, because he would have known Jeroboam cleared away down to Egypt for years and then reappeared on the scene to take advantage of this situation of weakness. Rehoboam knew, I have to be very careful just how I answer this. Now that will bring us to the next point. The reason for the conference, to get him crowned. The request that was put on the table at the conference, are you going to rule us with any kind of equality? Now what about his response? You see, this is where the difficulty comes in. Rehoboam, according to the reading here, he had two different sets of advisors. And the two sets of advisors, they gave him very different counsel. That left him with a choice which one he was going to follow. He had the old men, and the old men said to him, now Solomon, listen. Or Rehoboam, I'm keeping going back to Solomon, I think you follow what I'm saying. They said, Rehoboam, listen. Your father was fairly tough, and these people suffer. Now, if you're going to get this thing through, and if you're going to bring these people with you, he says you need to talk properly to them.
I could really see some of those old fellows saying, Rehoboam, your daddy wrote a verse and said, a soft answer turneth away wrath. Your daddy said that. So now you just follow what your daddy said on this point and be very soft with them. And don't antagonize them, and you can bring them with you. Now they say, Jeroboam's a rascal and he's a twister, so you'll have to be more careful than ever, because, dear brethren, I know. The biggest test for spiritual men in assembly government is this. When they have to deal with complaints that are made by carnal men. If you were only dealing with spiritual men, there wouldn't be half the problem. But when you're dealing with a carnal man, you have to be very, very sensitive. And so these old men said, now Rehoboam, tread you very, very softly. Don't be giving in on principle, but your father was too severe, and you should be just a little bit more relaxed. He came to the younger fellows. They said, no way. They said not at all. They say, you need to tell them straight. Tell them straight there's no nonsense here. If they don't want to pay more tax, they'll get out. My father used whips, I'm going to use scorpions. My father charged you $1 a day, I'm going to charge you $10 a day. There's going to be no change here. It's going to be worse. I'm going to show who's boss around here. These young fellas, you see, they just got into new office and they really wanted to show a new broom sweeps clean. And they really wanted to show their authority. And they maybe felt a little bit insecure. And they really wanted to make their mark and status and prestige. And the thrust of power had gone to their head. And they got round Solomon when he was still young. I was really encouraged with this today, because he was 41 years of age and the Bible still calls him young. Praise the Lord. You old people over 50, I just give you a sympathy card at the end of the meeting. So he got these young fellows around and he says, you see, that appealed to his ego. He says, these are the men. These are the go-ahead men. These are the men for the next generation. These are the men that are prepared to take the thing on, and they're prepared to rise to the challenge. And these are the men that have the thrust in my kingdom. These young men are my counselors. We'll go for them. And we just tell them straight right down the line. Was that the right attitude to take? When you have a problem, brethren, when you have people bringing a complaint, part of which is true, part of which is concocted, maybe a slant of carnality about it, how do you handle it?
Well, I say, as I have said already, if ever it takes wisdom, it's just that. And Rehoboam made a serious blunder when he followed the advice of the young men. It might have seemed to be progressive. It might have seemed to be political. But I'll tell you, it was absolute disaster. And because he was prepared to take their advice and push things so far, he drove a wedge into the kingdom of Israel, as I have said twice already in this meeting, that never was repaired. I'm convinced that if the whole history of assemblies were known, I don't think it would happen in Iowa or Wisconsin or wherever else might be represented in the meeting. I know it wouldn't happen. It could happen in Ireland, believe me. But I would say that the whole history of assemblies were known across the world, there's many a big division has been made because there were men prepared to push things too far. You say, Gilliland, you haven't got backbone in you at all. You're just a jellyfish of a boy. You're going back upon your whole ministry. No. You see, younger people need to watch. There again, I belong to that same thing. When you're young, there's not a problem that you couldn't solve. When I was 5 years in the assembly, that's back into my middle teens, I could have solved every problem in the north of Ireland. The preachers hadn't a clue, but I could have solved every one of them. And most of the problems, I would have just said, put them out. Every problem. I had no difficulty whatsoever. Now, the brethren in local assemblies don't ask me advice now, in that sense. I have no business in local assembly affairs. But if the brethren here were to ask me about the simplest problem in Iowa, you know what I would have to do now? I have to think about it. You see, everything seems to be cut and dried and simple and easy and black and white when you're young. There's no grey areas. Overthrew the government. That's a big thing that happens in our day. And you get a young fella and he gets a bit of things and he has 2 degrees and 3 PhDs and 4 XYZs that his old farmer grandfather never had, and he thinks, I'm just it, and these old fellas know nothing. And he gets a few round and he just would brush them out of the way. Listen, the men that have carried testimony before we were born, they deserve our respect until the Lord sees fit to take them home. They've been round too many corners and they've carry too many burdens, and they've prayed too many prayers, and they've shed too many tears to be dismissed with a wave of the hand by a modern youth. Younger men in the assembly here, always respect the older brethren, because God will honor you for it, and it's an investment for the future. The response, he just come and told them, he said, it's going to go worse than ever. Well, how did they react? You're not a bit surprised, too, you're not, that Jeroboam just took the bull by the horns. He was encouraged by the people. The people said, well, if that's the way it's going to be, we have no part in Solomon. We have no part with Rehoboam. We have no part with David. We are going out on our own. And they got Jeroboam. They got Jeroboam as their captain. And they certainly had no trouble persuading him, because a carnal man will always jump at position, just as we saw more at large on a previous night. And there was an ugly rent. The kingdom split into 10 and 2. Maybe it just didn't work out like that, but I'm not going into the finer details tonight. Now, that was a sad business. I'm not saying that division is always avoidable. I'm not saying that there are not times when division shouldn't take place, but I am saying most emphatically, dear brethren, that in the majority of cases, division amongst the Lord's people is nothing short of an absolute tragedy. What were they? They were a postage stamp on the world of international politics.
A little place from the north of the land to the south of the land was not very big. They were surrounded by enemies. They were surrounded by great powers that were just looking down upon them and waiting every chance to gobble up the land. And it was as much as they could do for the 12 of them together to keep these powers at bay. And now they're split into 10 and 2. And the enemies around just laugh at them and say, they're going to be a catwalk now. And they'd hardly split into 10 and 2, and the old Philistines down in the southwest, they jumped up again. David crushed them. David kept the kingdom together, and the Philistines couldn't move. The kingdom had hardly divided until the Philistines were up. And they couldn't cope with them. Then these boys, you see, the city of Jerusalem ruled over Syria in the north. When the division of the kingdom came, there was the southern kingdom, then there was the northern kingdom that weren't getting on with them, and then there was the Syrian kingdom way up in the north. Now these southern ones couldn't keep control over Syria in the north because the 10 tribes were in between. And the Edomites sprang up, and the Egyptians invaded. So on the north, the south, the east and the west, they began to be attacked from every side, and the end result of being torn in two was that they were severely weakened. I don't know how you think about it, but it seems to me that wherever you get division amongst the Lord's people, the only losers are really ourselves. The 10 tribes up there lost the temple. The king down here in Jerusalem, he lost the help of 10 tribes. They were sacrificing each other's assistance. They were fighting each other in a civil war, internal strife, when they should have been joined together to keep out the external enemies. Dear brethren, let me say this. We cannot give up principle. And if people are not prepared to obey the word of God, well then if they want to move, that's a different thing. But let me say this. We cannot afford to be divided, because we need each other. You see, this very thing happened in the New Testament. You say, I wish you would go to the New Testament instead of talking away about this stuff, Shechem and all that, and talk sensible to us. Well, in the New Testament, Acts chapter 15, there's going to be a divide. There's some very carnal men here, and they're going to make a Jewish church, and they're going to leave up with the Gentile church. Paul says, I doubt, he says, it'll never do. He says, what are we going to do? We'll have to have a conference. So they had a conference, Acts 15, and there's a problem, and their men just ready to press a split, because these men, if they can get a Jewish split, it's going to increase their power in the Jewish sector, and they just love it. And there's a big strong dissension takes place at the conference, and it's getting very, very ugly. And just when it's getting a little bit ugly, Peter stands up. He says, gentlemen, he says, well, we should take it easy. Take it easy. And when Peter has finished preaching, there's another fellow called James get up. He says, brethren, he says, what'd I tell you? He says, we should maybe look at the scriptures here. And then the elders get involved and they say, listen, brethren. We don't want to put a heavy yoke on the Gentiles and lay on them a burden that we couldn't carry. And they say, if you're going to put that big heavy yoke on the Gentiles, you're going to split the whole thing up. Isn't that exactly what happened here? He says, I'll make your yoke heavier than ever. And because he made it heavier, there was just a split. Now that same split could have happened in Acts 15. Only there were wise men that were able to prevent it. Now let me say one big thing that I noticed about this conference. When they came, when they had this problem, when the advice of the two sets of counselors disagreed, when they were just on the very edge of the precipice of partition, and Rehoboam knew if one group goes over the edge of this precipice, they're down. And it'll be irreparable forever. They're down. It's split up for good. He knew all that. You would think he would have said, look, I doubt, gentlemen, we should pray. Or you'd have thought he at least would have said, could you not send for a prophet? There's not the sign of a prophet. There's not the sign of a prayer. There's not the sign of any need for God. There's not the sign of calling upon help. Everything is just going to be solved and settled by human brains.
And it's no surprise to me the whole thing finished up with a mess. Maybe if we prayed about things more, got the Bible, got the scriptures and the sanctuary. The scriptures plus the sanctuary might produce more solutions instead of these splits just that I have been talking about. Now, they've got a divide. The rent has been terrible. I know it was prophesied. I would love to go back into that prophecy. One of the strange things that Solomon was doing, Solomon was the man that encouraged Jeroboam. You read about this back in chapter 11, the previous chapter. When Jeroboam was just a young fellow, his mother was a widow. He didn't come from great stock. He didn't come from a wealthy family. Maybe the loss of a father in the home had something to do with the way he acted. He was always wanting to prove himself. He was always wanting to make his mark. He was very competitive. The absence of a father could sometimes do that on a young person's personality, authority in the home. I'm not sure. He was the son of a widow. Anyway, he was a man of great capability and competitive. And Solomon was doing some building around Jerusalem. And he saw this young man was fairly capable. And he encouraged him. And it was no time at all until he was over the whole works. And Solomon put him in a position what we would call, I don't know what you'd call it maybe on this side, but we call it the clerk of works. And he got quite a responsible position in Solomon's administration. And it was then he had the fallout and he went away down to Egypt for years. He went to Solomon's father-in-law. Maybe Solomon and the father-in-law weren't getting on too well. I don't think they did. And then the one that succeeded that. But away down in Egypt. Now what I'm saying is this. Solomon never dreamt that he was encouraging a young man that would just wreck the thing in the next generation. Sometimes older brethren have seen that. They see a young man in the assembly. They maybe do their best to coax him along. They see that he shows a little bit of ability. They give him a place in the Sunday school. And they give him a little bit of responsibility in other areas. And maybe they live long enough to see that the very young man whom they encouraged, he turns round and ousts them out of power. Very sad situation. Here was a man who was a carnal opportunist, just looking for an opportunity to assert his own rights. Well, what about the repair of this thing? When Rehoboam saw what was happening, he really got concerned. When he saw that he had gone too far, in the response, the reply that he gave at the conference, when he saw he had gone too far, he really got concerned and he said, I better try and backpedal. I better try and backtrack. This poor creature, he got worse. Because once men make foolish decisions, they just seem to go from bad to worse. The inspector of his taxes was a fellow called Adoram, or Adoniram. Adoram in this chapter. He was the inspector of taxes. Do you have inspector of taxes in this country, or the chief, the head man of the taxes? Now, the people up in the north hated him. Tax men are really loved, aren't they? The people up in the north, hated, because he was the man that legislated for all these taxes that I was talking about, and the people up there hated him. Now, so when Rehoboam saw the way things were going, you know what he said to Adonai? He said, Adoram, he says, you go up and see if you can sort them out. When they saw him, they stoned him to death. How could Rehoboam be so daft? How could he be so foolish? If he had closed his eyes and turned round in 40 circles and picked a man and said, well, let that man go to town and help, he couldn't have picked a worse man than Adoram. He sent the man to sort it out whom the people hated most. You talk about tact. I don't know, they say you shouldn't have diplomacy in assembly things, but at least you should have a little bit of common gumption or a little bit of common sense. Then absolutely, he had no sense. He sent the worst man that he could think of. They stoned him to death, and Rehoboam had to jump into his Chevy and head back to Jerusalem as hard as he could go, and he just got in by the skin of his teeth, and he said, that was a close one. You know what Paul said? There are two women here not getting on too well in a place called Philippi. He says, we need somebody to help them. Who are you going to get to do it, Paul?
He says, I beseech thee through Eupharo. Isn't that a lovely thing?
Paul says there's a man in Philippi and he's a yoke fellow. He says he can work on a yoke. He says he has worked with me. He has worked with, and he said he's been a great partner to work with. And he said a man who himself is a good partner, he said he's the very man to try and get these two women back again into partnership. Solomon, Rehoboam sent the worst man. He was, then when he got back into his Chevy and into Jerusalem and thought of it, he says, I'll tell you what I'll do. He says, I'll get an army and I'll go up and I'll beat the head off them. And he says, what I can't do by diplomacy, he said, I'll do by force. And he gathered up, what was it, about 180,000 soldiers. And he says, I have made a mess of this, but he says, I'm going to force them jamming together again. Just when he was starting to get out through the gate, a prophet met him. He says, Solomon, get back in. Rehoboam, get back in. He said, it's too late. He said, you have made a blunder and the division has happened. And he said, what has happened over Philippi, he says, it's too late. It cannot be cured by force. Mind you, dear brethren, these are very serious principles. I dread them. I dread being confronted by them in my own life. But we can make a foolish decision. And we can go too far. And we can push a thing over a brink. And we can see a split take place there. And then we can try some move. What has been split by our folly, we try to force it together. The Lord says, Rehoboam, you'll not do it. He says, it has happened through your folly. And he said, I'm going to let you reap the consequences of your own sin. It's a sad thing in Christian life, whether young or old, any of us overseers or ordinary believers like ourselves, it's a sad thing that we have to face in life, that God very often punishes us, chastises us, by letting us live with the consequences of our own decisions. Now, the repair was no good. What about the result of it? Well, the split has taken place. What about this man, Jeroboam? And I'll soon let you go. I see people here have come a couple of hours' journey. I was going to preach last night until 9:15. I stopped at 9:10, and the brethren have all encouraged me to go to 9:15. But just for the sake of you people who have travelled, I'm going to stop at 5 or 10 minutes. So you can take. I can't get the subject finished, but I'll stop. What were the results of this? Well, here's Jeroboam. Now they're going to have in a small land, they're going to have a new centre. He's taken Shechem. You remember last night old Abimelech knocked Shechem down. Jeroboam goes, and the first thing that he does, he builds up Shechem as his capital. And that's in opposition. That's a centre in opposition to Jerusalem. You say, what? What? You see, in one small country, we're going to have a centre, and we're going to have another thing in separate, and the whole group are supposed to be brethren in the one family, the family of Jacob. You say, it's ludicrous! It'll never work! Two centres! That's what you're going to have. Division always produces two centres where there should only be one. A kingdom with a counterfeit centre. Not only did you have a new centre, but you had a new circumference. Because he put something at Bethel, and he put something at Dan. You see, at the bottom of his heart, Jeroboam wasn't really a religious man at all. And that was seen by the policy that he adopted. He said, when David came to the kingdom down below, he made his political capital at Jerusalem, and he said he made Jerusalem his religious capital. And he made the center of his kingdom just the one thing. Political things was here, religious things are all in the one center. He said, I don't want that. He said, I want to have political things at Shechem in the center. He said, I'm going to put religious things and the worship out to the side. He said, politics to me is the central thing, religion is peripheral. Another reason that this kingdom had a strange circumference was that it was just to be convenient. He said, we only have the kind of religion that suits people. Don't want them to have to travel too far. We don't want them to have to do too much. It'll be nice and handy for them down there. You know, that's really the kind of thinking that informs most most modern day religion, so long as it's easy for people and it's convenient, doesn't involve too much sacrifice, not too much distance, not too much hardship, just make it easy. Whether it's what God really wanted or not will not be too particular, but so long as it's nice and handy. He had a new center, he had a new circumference, and he had a new chapel. He built a chapel. That's the name that's given to later on in the Bible. It's called the King's Chapel. So that you had God's sanctuary, you had God's dwelling place here, and you have a chapel just up the road a bit, a few miles. You see what division produced? There should have been nothing but the sanctuary of the Lord, and now there's a pagan shrine at this new chapel. And what does he have in the chapel? Well, why did he even build a chapel? Because he made a calf, and he just didn't want the rain to get at it. So he built this chapel, and he put the old calf underneath the cover. You say, where did he read about calves, and where did he see about calves? How did this man know to have the religion of God associated with a calf? Well, you know the place that he saw that was just down in Egypt. And into the worship of God he brought things that he had seen in Egypt. And I don't know, dear brethren and sisters, I cannot help but feel, you know, if Christianity had all been united as God expected it to be, what a power would we have been in this world. You think of how many chapels, I'm not talking about any building, I'm talking about false systems. You think of how many calves, you think of how many things have been brought into the service of the Lord, and the things really belong to Egypt. Little bits of games and sports and recreations and barbecue teas and things like that. Those are calves that people worship there, and they've been brought into the holy worship of God. That's what this, when you get a chapel, you're going to need a calf, because that's an Egyptian calf. And then he brought in a new consecration. No longer, you don't need to be a Levite anymore. If you're going to serve at this, you don't need to show your birth certificate. You don't need to prove that you really belong to the priestly family. Anybody gets it. Anybody gets in. You say, what happened? he just started an open fellowship. Don't think of me any night. Don't talk about where were you born, what family do you belong to. I will say this very seriously, dear brother. Once we weaken on conversion, it's the beginning of the end. When people are going to be brought into God's assembly to serve in priestly capacity, the biggest and the most important thing is not a man's education. And the most important thing is not that he has married somebody. And the most important thing is not his personality. The most important thing is this: has he or she got a good clean birth certificate? And are you absolutely sure they're really born again? Jeroboam started this counterfeit sort of worship, and he said, it doesn't matter about priestly families. He said, everybody come, whoever you are, and we'll take you all on board. And I tell you, it must have been some jumble sale of a place before very, very. Do you see what division produces? And then another thing that he was very firm about, he says, I tell you what I don't want. He says, I don't want any of my people to go up to Jerusalem. He says, I don't want that. Not only did the division happen, but it became very bitter. And he says, I don't want them to go to that thing, because if they go up there and see what's right, they mightn't come back to me. I have noticed, brethren, when people turn away from assembly things, and they start up something as a counterfeit opposition, they become so bitter that they wouldn't come back near the place. They finish forever, and they wouldn't even look the way the assemblies are. And there seems to be a bitterness. He had a new calendar, because instead of a feast in the seventh month, he had a feast in the eighth month. He just changed things around, didn't matter. It said he just did it according to the devices of his own heart. And the man, you say, who was to blame for this division? You say you've mixed up your message, and I'm just going to pray. You say you started off by blaming Rehoboam. You said he was too hard. And you say now you're blaming Jeroboam. Who was it blame for him? Well, I think it was just a bit of both. It was Rehoboam really pushed the thing too far and created the division.
It was already in the heart of Jeroboam. He didn't need too much pushing, but Rehoboam pushed it too far. Jeroboam was ready to jump at it. And when Rehoboam pushed it too far, I tell you, Jeroboam took it further than ever we would think a thing could go. And Shechem, that used to be the place of consecration. Shechem, that used to be the place where Jacob buried the idols beneath the tree. Shechem has now become the place where idols are actually worshipped, where God has been displayed, and where the affections of the people have been carried away after other things. Dear brethren, my message tonight is this: be very careful how you handle conflicts. Be very careful how you handle carnal complaints. It takes the wisdom of Solomon and a bit more than that beside, because I fear some divisions could have been averted. Some cannot be averted. Some could have been, if there just had been a little bit more caution and a little bit more wisdom. Shall we pray?